Welcome to Important, Not Important. My name is Quinn Emmett.
And my name is Brian Colbert Kennedy.
Are you mocking me?
No.
Okay. Today's question, hey Brian, is there nuclear waste in the ocean? And two, can I become a superhero if there is? And then just, we should talk about the pros and cons of both of those things.
I will swim in so much ocean for so long if there's a possibility of me becoming a superhero. You have no idea.
God, Jesus. Please. Our guest is the esteemed Dr. Claudia Benitez Nelson. She is the Distinguished Professor of Earth, Ocean, and Environment at the University of South Carolina, where she researches one thing. I'm kidding. She researches biogeochemistry and geochemistry, because obviously she couldn't do just one of those.
She's not a slacker.
Oh, kidding again. Also climate change, coastal processes, oceanography, policy, water resources, and hydrology.
I studied theater for 1 year.
Dr. Benitez Nelson is the co-author of a paper last year on the fallout from the Fukushima disaster and how it affected the Pacific Ocean and everything we're in 7 years later. Holy cow, did I learn some shit today.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised.
And excited and terrified and pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And yes. She was very kind to slow things down for us at times.
Yeah, we had to take a few steps back, hey, what does that mean? And she was so sweet about it and helpful.
Yeah, and I will say again, without getting too much into it, the goal of these things, as always, is to inform better conversations. And I feel 10,000% better informed on nuclear power and the pros and cons than ever prior before. Which I guess, I think prior before are the same words.
Prior and before. You just said, it's a little bit redundant, but we all get it.
Great. Let's go have this conversation with the smartest person on the planet. Great. Okay. Our guest today is Dr. Claudia Benitez Nelson. And together we're going to discuss, Brian, true or false, there is nuclear waste in the ocean. Get excited. Dr. Benitez Nelson, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Can't wait to get the answer to that question as we dig into this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, if you wouldn't mind just starting off by telling us all who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm a professor in the School of the Earth, Ocean, and Environment in the University of South Carolina. And I am an oceanographer, and I use natural and artificially occurring radionuclides to look at a variety of processes in the ocean, how material makes its way into the ocean and how it mixes around, and then what happens to it once it gets here. That's what I tell my parents.
Perfect.
Got it. My parents just shake their heads at me at this point. They're very patient.
They're very proud.
Awesome.
I come into these podcasts knowing not a ton, so that I can be a voice for our listeners and ask lots of questions. And so I can only assume that there is some bad stuff going on with the ocean. So we're going to get into that. And we are going to, by the end of this or throughout it, come up with some action steps that our listeners can take to help support you and help clean up this dang ocean.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Good. We're really glad because that's why you're here.
Yeah, let's fix this thing, especially with some of that ocean news that's come out this week. Yeah. Good times. Doctor, we start with one important question, something to set the tone a little bit. Instead of saying, tell us your whole life story, as fascinating as I'm sure that is, we like to ask, Doctor, why are you vital to the survival of the species?
Oh my goodness. I guess I'm speechless. Mm-hmm. That's a rare event for me. In terms of, my research, I guess I don't feel like I'm all that vital to the survival of species.
Be bold.
I mean, I do good work, I think I contribute. I doubt that I will ever win a Nobel Prize or, a MacArthur Fellowship, although I wouldn't turn them down. I think that I'm probably the most vital in that I think it's really important to bring people together who have very different views and to teach and communicate kind of the work I do and kind of this amazing earth we live on to the kind of the next generation. I think that's where I'm really making my mark at this point in time. I think everybody should know how the world works and what an amazing place it is. And I think that's how I'm contributing, I think, to our future and our hopefully very positive and optimistic future on this planet.
I love that.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. We always get that initial like, oh, I don't know. And then this great answer follows.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad it's a great answer.
Oh, hell yeah, man. It is so vital what you are doing, both in your research and your day-to-day life, passing on to the next generation who, if we haven't made clear enough on this podcast, is going to have to save us all.
Yeah.
So people like you
and
are pretty essential.
I am very confident that they're going to. Let me tell you, I teach such amazingly smart and innovative and just thought-provoking students. It really just gives me such great pleasure to think about our future in a very positive way.
That is so incredible to hear.
I'll take it. Holy cow. Awesome. All right, so let's dig into this a little bit. So we're here on the west coast of the United States, Los Angeles to be specific. You know, about 7.5 years ago, something went down in Japan that scared a lot of people in a lot of places. The Fukushima nuclear power plant went boom, boom. And that was for a very specific, quote unquote, act of God.
Boom, boom. I like that.
Yeah. The plant, or I guess what's left of it, is, for reference, is located on the east coast of Japan, a little bit north of Tokyo. It was commissioned in 1971, is one of the 15 most powerful nuclear stations on the planet. And sadly, on March 11, 2011, Japan was crushed by a 9.0 earthquake and a subsequent tsunami. So I'm going to kind of parse what Wikipedia has here about what happened. The active reactors automatically shut down their sustained fission reactions. However, the tsunami disabled the emergency generators that would have provided power to control and operate the pumps necessary to cool them down. The insufficient cooling led to 3 nuclear meltdowns, hydrogen air explosions, and the release of radioactive material. Loss of cooling also raised concerns over the recently loaded spent fuel pool, which is not helpful. So clearly a 9.0 earthquake and tsunami are nothing to fuck with. God knows what they would do to Los Angeles or anywhere on the East Coast. And yet, further, the operator was found later to have failed to meet a variety of basic safety requirements. So the Fukushima disaster is called the worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. Bad news for sure, but here's the thing. There's only been one reported fatality on account of the disaster. The United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation and the World Health Organization report that there will be no increase in miscarriages, stillbirths, or physical and mental disorders in babies born after the accident. Of course, nuclear waste has quite the shelf life, and we're just 7 years later, yeah. So who knows? Why is this all important? Well, because the word nuclear scares a shitload of people. And it excites.
It absolutely does.
And you know what? It excites just as many, depending on whichever way you see it, right? Nuclear power is either a temporary stepping stone to a much cleaner energy future, a hiccup we've had along the way, an abomination, a relic of the past, or actually a significant piece for a clean energy future. And I got to tell you, among those disparate groups, there's not a lot of middle ground that I have seen, which is unfortunate, but also not surprising in 2018. And because of the mostly relatively unwarranted fears, we've done a pretty shit job across the world of developing, standardizing, and commercializing the next generation of nuclear plants. Again, Fukushima was commissioned in 71. That was a 40-year-old plant.
Yeah.
So most of the current ones are like that. They're pretty old. All that said, perspective is important. Coal is a health nightmare on the mining and production fronts on a day-to-day fucking basis, right? Fracking causes earthquakes, which is not great. And you can ask the folks in Boston, it can help cause gas lines to explode. But people get worried. I get it. And for the past 7 years, West Coasters have been pretty terrified about nuclear waste washing up in their water and on the beach. So we would like to dig in and set the record straight, or at least use our podcast as a vessel of sorts for our esteemed guest to set the record straight while we stand by and let her do her thing. So, Doctor, with that for some context, let's focus on our topic. True or false, there's nuclear waste in the ocean. Good or bad? Let's find out. So if we can cut to it real quick, the question everybody wants answered, right? We've been waiting almost a decade, and all your research, all your travels, the trials, the tribulations, the late nights, the papers, the revelations, the setbacks, have you found any evidence whatsoever that I could go swimming in the Pacific and become a superhero?
Unfortunately not. As much as I would love for all of us to go swimming in the ocean and become superheroes.
Oh, that'd be so cool. That is,
yeah, yeah.
Fine.
No, I mean, you've raised a lot of really good points. And, you know, I agree with you. You say the words radioactivity or radiation, and it just provokes this real visceral response about just fear and angst. And that is an issue. I mean, we have radioactivity all around us. We consume radioactivity on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. We are exposed to radiation when we fly in planes or we sleep next to our loved ones. And so that does not mean that is in all cases you can have too much of a good thing, right? So too much exposure can certainly lead to lots and lots of bad health effects. But I think trying to understand and just have some kind of baseline knowledge of what radioactivity is, what radiation is really important if you even want to start the conversation. I live here in South Carolina. I live very close to a number of power plants, nuclear power plants that have been decommissioned, and there's always concerns about leaks and big waste sites and what happens with that radioactivity. And I always have to say, well, I'm actually not so worried about the radioactivity. I'm worried about all those organic pollutants and all those other things that they've been, you know, putting into the groundwater that I think is going to get me first. So, you know, yeah. So again, you know, I think there's just a lot of misinformation about radioactivity that, you know, just makes it difficult to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's wild.
I think a very important start. So are there any misunderstandings, myths, conspiracies that you would like to correct off the bat so that we can get off on the right foot here?
Yes.
Please.
What do you think is the number one cause of death from, you know, radioactivity? What do you think is the most highest exposure to radioactivity, like in the world, where you're at, anything like that? Can you make some guesses?
Well, you said we couldn't become a superhero, supervillain, so it's not
that.
Right.
You can't.
Does like how many people die of skin cancer? Not that many.
Skin cancer, microwaves.
Microwaves, right? Right. Maybe if you lived near Chernobyl.
Sure. Yeah, right. Maybe. I don't know. Just hit me. What do we got?
Smoking. Smoking is the largest. If you're a smoker, you get the highest dose of radiation than anyone, relatively speaking. Because what? I know. They get the highest dose of ionizing
radiation. I truly don't understand
radiation.
Why people are smoking cigarettes anymore.
And like, you know, yeah, you worry about like the tar and like all the toxins, etc. But there is naturally occurring radioactivity that accumulates in, you know, tobacco products. And when you smoke, you're inhaling those radioactive elements into your lungs, and they're just radiating the crap out of it.
It's in the tobacco?
Yeah. And so when you're smoking it, the polonium, it's radioactive polonium and lead, it literally, the smoke gets into your lungs and you're just getting exposed to huge amounts of ionizing radiation.
Have you seen how cool people look though when they smoke? So,
they do.
Pretty good argument, huh?
Maybe.
Oh my God. That's really wild.
Okay.
But you know, so you think about, you know, oh my gosh, you know, I'm worried about living near my nuclear power plant. I'm worried about, you know, nuclear waste. And I'll just say to you, hey, don't smoke. That would be a good start.
A friend, an older friend went to a doctor once sometime in the past few years and came home and humbly told me this story about going in and, you know, it's Los Angeles. They went in and they're like, oh, okay. They got a list of like, I've heard I should follow this diet and I should do this thing and I should eat this specific thing and not eat gluten and this and this. And the doctor is like, maybe just stop fucking smoking two specks of cigarettes today. Why don't we start there, champ?
Wow.
And right? that is without me knowing about the radioactivity, yeah. which is...
It wow. was already terrible.
Okay, what else you got? Blow some more minds here.
Okay, so we are naturally exposed to radiation all the time. We get some from the sun's rays, right? That's why, mm-hmm. you know, you put on sunscreen. But you know that our exposure to radioactivity has actually increased over the last several decades? Hmm. Do you want to know, can you guess as to why?
Now, no.
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 Is it cigarettes?
No, is it, yeah. actually, it's not. It's because we go in for more medical testing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, when you go in to get radiation therapy or x-rays, just x-rays, right? That's where we're getting a lot more of our exposure to radiation these days, as opposed to, you know, nuclear fallout, swimming in the ocean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's medical. Who knew?
All right. That's, yeah, wow.
Not us.
Now, it's still low. Let me just say, it's still low, right? We're sure. talking, you know.
It's all relative, yeah.
Yeah, it's all relative. But that's where that's where we get our biggest exposure to radiation. And that's why it's increased. So the more industrialized nations, you get higher exposures to radiation because mm-hmm. you are, you know, you have more access to better healthcare.
Sure. Sure. Well, theoretically, better healthcare.
Yeah.
Theoretically, right? Right.
So, you know. All right. So now that that's in context, which is crazy, talk to us about what you know happened after that disaster with the ocean. Because again, obviously, Japan is an island nation, and what it looks like. Because I know you've put together some papers on the subject and what's going on there. So just so we can set everyone's mind straight on that front.
That's great. So I have a wonderful colleague who's really been leading the way in a lot of this work, and that's Ken Bissler, and he's at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And, you know, essentially what happened was we had this enormous earthquake, this huge tsunami that came in, killed actually quite a number, I think over 15,000 people. But wow. in the process of that tsunami and that earthquake hitting the coast of Japan, it essentially, you know, broke, for lack of a better word, you know, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants. They had a meltdown, they had a semi-meltdown, and they released a lot of radiation into the atmosphere and into the coastal ocean. So when we talk about radioactivity, there's a lot of different kinds of radiation. And so mm-hmm. that can be confusing. The kind of the big three that we're really concerned with that was released from Fukushima are iodine 131 and then cesium 134 and cesium 137. These are three very different elements. There are two elements, and so they have very different reactivities and how they enter into the oceans and then what happens to them. Iodine 131 really only lasts about, you know, 17, 18 days. It degrades really quickly. It decays with an 8-day half-life. So by 16 days after that, you know, initial explosion, you were down to like 25% of the iodine 131 that was released, right? So it went away really quickly.
Can I ask right? a dumb question? And that's sure. we try to ask a lot of these. Where does it go? You're saying it decays and the half-life is, I'm sorry, 8 days or 16 days. Because I know a lot of people talk about, you know, the enormously, you know, long shelf life of variations on nuclear waste, which, as you say, is pretty complicated terminology. Where is it decaying to, and what does it become like once it's in the ocean, I guess, after that half-life?
Okay. So I think we should just take a step back
Please.
And think about, like, what is radiation?
Yes,
right?
Yeah,
what
yes,
is
do it.
Perfect.
What
do
is it. It, right? So we talk about radioactivity in kind of the simplest sense. Mm-hmm. It is like alchemy, right? It's mm-hmm. it's the spontaneous change of one element mm-hmm. into another.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And it's spontaneously kind of doing this because it has all of this excess energy and it makes it unstable. And it wants to get down to that stable place, right? Mm-hmm. It wants to get as stable as it can possibly be. And so when it does that kind of instantaneous transformation, it emits energy or radiation, and that's in the form of these particles. And so when we talk about decay, we're talking about the emission of this radiation, and it can be a bunch of different types of radiation, and this, you know, spontaneous change from one element into another. And they can be very different elements with regards to their reactivities, you know, how they, you know, react in an ecosystem, etc. So when iodine-131 decays, it decays through several pathways, but it decays to xenon.
Okay.
And xenon is pretty unreactive, right? And so it decays to xenon, and then xenon kind of hangs around, and that's okay.
Okay, that's what we're looking for.
That's what you offer. So it's my long-winded answer, but
that's important. Everybody, you know, is riding around on their public transportation is like, when is she going to say it's okay?
Right.
Okay, got it.
So I have a short follow-up. In those 16 days when 75% of the iodine-131 decayed and disappeared into xenon or whatever, did it fuck shit up in those 16 days?
So that's a technical question.
Oh yes,
right. Did it screw stuff up?
Yes, ma'am.
Not that we know of.
Okay.
I mean, it looks like it went in and it dispersed really quickly.
Okay,
fascinating.
Right. There's two other radioactive elements. There's cesium. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there's two different ones. There's cesium-134 and cesium-137. And they exist in the oceans for very different amounts of time. One is for 2 years and the other is for 30 years.
Whoa.
Okay, that's different.
And I know. So the 30-year one, you're like, oh, okay.
Right.
You know, that could be, you know, pretty big. But it turns out that once it entered into the ocean, I guess I hate to use this terminology, but we talk a lot about, you know, the answer to pollution is dilution. Mm-hmm. So for, you know, a lot of the radioactivity that came out of Fukushima into the oceans, it got diluted fairly quickly. Hmm. And it got diluted to levels that are just relatively quickly far below what we even worry about in terms of nuclear regulatory standards. So by that I mean is it's so low that they don't even measure it and we don't care about it. And there are no impacts that we are aware of at all. And so there might have been some detrimental effects that we think that were in fish, because fish can actually take up cesium, and fish may have been exposed to some type of detrimental impact as long as maybe 2 or even 3 years after the radiation was emitted. And, mm-hmm. you know, but there's no evidence whatsoever that it has had any impact on humans who consume the fish. The fish themselves, we think they could have had an impact on them, but we don't have any real evidence that there was that much impact on them.
That's fascinating, because I just finished digging through Paul Greenberg. He wrote Four Fish, American Catch, and then a new one about the omega-3 economy, basically. And he enlightened me. I did not realize that the U.S. imports about 80% of their of our seafood, which is insane. And we export about 80%. The same amount. So I'm just, you know, with a lot of things like the shrimp coming from Thailand and things like that, that was my next question is, okay, so if it dissipated in the ocean, what about the marine life and further the marine life that we consume?
Yeah. And so that's the amazing thing is, you know, even though this radiation was emitted into the atmosphere and into the oceans, what actually went into the oceans was diluted. You know, if you get really, really close to the plant, you saw very, you know, much higher levels relative to what you typically find in seawater. And but those levels with regards to their impact on us, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, was surprising, it was low, right? So we're just really good at measuring radiation and anthropogenic radiation because we worry about it a lot. Right. So we can detect really, really, really small quantities. And so, but just because we can detect it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be harmful to those who, you know, to us as we consume it or stand next to it or et cetera. And in fact, that's actually a really tough thing to do is, you know, figure out what those impacts really are kind of on the long term.
So that's interesting. So I'm curious where everyone stands now, because it sounds like the mantra isn't like, hey, it turns out everything is fine. I mean, I'm sure it's much more complicated than that, but considering the long term, what is the outlook going forward on this particular disaster?
Actually, it's pretty positive. I mean, the good news is that these are what we call short-lived radioactive elements. So the iodine is already gone, right? 131, it's already gone. It's been 5 years. It's long gone. Cesium-134 has a half-life of 2 years. So it means that every 2 years, about half of what you started with is gone, right? So cesium-134, it's you know, pretty low at this point.
Right.
Right. And then there's cesium-137 that has a half-life of 30 years. So every 30 years, about half of what you started with disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, the activities that were released into the ocean got diluted very, you know, relatively quickly. Or many of them, some of that got picked onto particles and sank to the really deep seafloor where it's gotten buried. Now, it's possible that as it gets buried, it can get mixed and it can maybe make its way into the organisms that live on the sea floor.
Mm-hmm.
But the activities that we're measuring or that have been measured, again, are relatively low. There's no indication that these organisms have detrimental effects from it. So the short answer is, if I went to Japan and somebody offered me seafood, would I eat it? And the answer would be absolutely.
So clearly there are other radioactive elements. Did this end up not being so bad just because what ended up getting spilled in the ocean just didn't happen to be that bad? Like, it could have been much worse, right?
That's a great question. And I think that's where I want to talk a little bit about assumptions.
Okay, yeah, sorry. So it's been 7 years. Where does this disaster rank on assumptions? I mean, it was Japan's an island nation. It's got a 40-year-old top 15 most powerful nuclear power plant. Gets just destroyed by an earthquake and a tsunami. What was everybody's initial assumption? Like
professional, not Brian.
Not me. No, not me. But professional assumptions on how bad it could be specifically.
Oh, I mean, there were concerns, right? I mean, we went there right away and everyone was wearing, you know, dosimetry badges, which measures radiation pretty quickly, you know, because there was a lot of concern. Wow, how much was released? Was this, you know, where did it go? In many ways, having it go into the oceans was probably the best place where it could have gone, right? Because it can get diluted and mixed out relatively quickly. We can compare it to, for example, Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Chernobyl, when that nuclear accident happened, it happened on land and a lot of the radioactivity settled right there. Oof. And so, you know, that made it, you know, a much more impactful radioactive event,
mm-hmm.
specifically to us, you know, who live on land. And so that was, you know, that was kind of a big deal.
Sure. Whereas,
It had nowhere to go. Whereas, you know, Chernobyl in perspective, you know, or excuse me, Fukushima in perspective, you know, it got into the oceans and, you know, it diluted away. And, you know, we've had a number of accidents, you know, over the history of, you know, radioactivity in the environment. Everything from kind of the accidents that we hear a lot about. So Chernobyl, it released like 5,000 petabecquerels of radioactivity into the environment. Fukushima released 500, right? So it's an order of magnitude lower, just to put things in perspective. But, you know, we've had planned releases from nuclear fuel reprocessing plants that we've just, you know, kind of let go into the ocean.
Oh,
right. Yeah, we've done that. I know. In fact, from what we know, there are nuclear fuel reprocessing plants. There's two, the Sellafield and the Cap de la Hague, which are in the United Kingdom and France. It's released about 40 petabecquerels to the oceans over its time, both what they did on purpose and maybe what they kind of did and shouldn't have. That's actually more than what we think, the same amount of, you know, becquerels that were released by Fukushima to the oceans.
Could you just do me a quick favor and define becquerel? Is that like a, like for
so
everybody?
Sorry,
no,
totally
it's fine.
Nerded.
It's just like, is that a, like a backpack full or
a large
oh suitcase?
God.
Like what do we,
And you also, was there another one, a peta becquerel? There was like two forms.
I know. I totally nerded out on you.
No,
you
it was awesome.
Look, nerding out's great. We're going to let you go with it. Yeah. But then occasionally we need to step back and say, it's clear that you're just making up words at this point. So if you could just detail them out for us, that would be great.
Okay. So those of us who kind of live and breathe radioactivity, we don't like to talk in terms of atom or grams of material. We tend to talk things of atoms of material. And we talk about, so we're really small, okay? And then when we talk about radioactive substances, we like to talk about their existence in the environment and the radioactivity that they emit. So we'll talk about them in terms of disintegrations or radioactive events per second or per minute or how per year, right? This is kind of our language. And a becquerel is a disintegration per second. So how much radiation is being emitted, you know, necessarily disintegrations per second, how it's decaying. And a petabecquerel is one million billion becquerels. It's
Brian,
10 to the 15th becquerels.
Brian is so furiously scribbling on a cocktail now.
15 zeros after.
Zero, 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 zero.
But this is, again, it seems like a lot, right? You're like, oh my gosh, it's 1 million billion becquerels.
Right.
But we're talking atoms, right? These are just, so, you know, it is a much smaller scale because that's how we measure it.
On a super tiny scale.
Super tiny scale, I know.
Hi, it's Brian. Quinn's making Earl Grey tea. I got a quick favor. Every podcast you listen to begs for a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And here's why. Not everybody listens on Apple Podcasts, like you might not be doing right now, but 70% of our listeners and most podcast listeners are on Apple Podcasts. And the top charts are a huge source of even more new listeners. So here's the deal. Some unholy combination of downloads and ratings and reviews drive up those top charts. And we like being on those top charts and getting new listeners. So we need your help. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts right this second, it's super easy. It'll take 5 seconds. If you're staring at the episode screen, swipe down. And then down at the bottom, tap the little library button. Then tap our show. Scroll down to ratings and reviews and do the damn thing. It takes 1 second to hit a star and then like another 5 seconds to write a review. We'll wait. Great. Thank you. We love you. Now back to the episode.
Okay. So this is interesting. So basically we went in, you know, fearing, as Brian said, all those factors. Oh my God, they get crushed by earthquake and tsunami. It's on the coast. It's an old one, but it's very powerful. Everything is spilling into the ocean, into the water and the food on a city that relies on seafood and, you know, into our biggest ocean and the currents and all this. And yet it seems like it went okay. So I guess two questions, which is one, going back to Brian's question, which is, did it come down to what actually went into the ocean? Was that everything or is that just a part of it? Or did we get lucky that X didn't go into the ocean? Could you just clarify that bigger picture a little bit? Like, was this the whole of a nuclear disaster went to the ocean? It turned out it went bad. Or was it just like, oh my God, we got lucky. These three pieces were the only thing.
No, I mean, we did get lucky. I mean, it didn't, you know, fully go into full meltdown mode. You know, there was a release, there was explosions, but it could have been much worse. I can't tell you the absolute magnitude, but we were just lucky in that it, you know, that's what was released. We were able to shut it down. It released, you know, material into the atmosphere that actually all settled down on Japan. And, you know, they've been working to clean it up, but it's been, you know, very low levels. And so we, yes, we're lucky and the oceans are good.
Fascinating.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So it's an interesting question. I mean, we have, you know, the oceans are naturally radioactive because we have all these naturally occurring radioactive elements that just exist in our oceans all the time.
I think that's a really important point to make. Could you just clarify that a little bit? Because I think people see oceans, which I love and should remain this way, as these pristine things, mm-hmm. but they're very complicated. And if you could just explain that quickly, I'd really appreciate it.
So we have naturally occurring radioactive elements on this planet. We do. Potassium. You eat radioactivity when you have a banana.
Mm-hmm. I love bananas. I have banana every day.
I mm-hmm. love bananas, right? So we eat it. And in the oceans, we have naturally occurring radioactivity. It's just part of the chemistry of the ocean. It's from, erosion of rocks, etc. And so the average radioactivity you might find in the ocean is on the order of 1 becquerel. Per 1,000 liters, right? 1 to 2 becquerels per 1,000 liters. That's what we typically exist in the ocean. If you're looking at cesium, for an example.
Yeah, sure.
All right. But if you go to, say, remember I was talking about up to Sellafield or the North Sea, and you look at, right, that mm-hmm. radioactivity, it could be as high as 60 becquerels per 1,000 liters.
Why is that?
Because they were releasing nuclear fuel into
the thing you just told us about. Yes,
got it.
Right.
You go to Japan, and at one point there was high as about 2 to 3 becquerels per 1,000 liters, and now it's declines every day. It gets lower, every day because of that anthropogenic impacts. So, I just want to put that in perspective in terms of what naturally exists. So if you were to look at all of the cesium in the ocean, you would have about, let's use that petabecquerel number, that 1 million billion becquerels, sure. Right? So from uranium that just naturally exists in the ocean, nobody did anything to the ocean, that's where it is. We have about 37,000 petabecquerels that just exists in the ocean from uranium. That's uranium itself.
Wow. Man.
I know.
Today is like a masterclass.
Yes, it's crazy.
Potassium-40. Potassium is that radioactive element that exists in bananas and we eat it.
Sure.
Right? That's on that's 15 million petabecquerels.
What?
I know, I'm blowing your mind. Now, keep in mind that, radiation is different. All elements, give off different types of radiation. Yeah. But I just want to, if you were to do all of the global nuclear weapons testing that happened throughout the 1950s and the 1960s, and you're like, okay, how much did it add to the oceans? You're at 1,000 petabecquerels.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So way lower, way lower. Chernobyl, about 85 petabecquerels. And Fukushima, maybe about 40, 50 petabecquerels. And that's really, 10 to 60, depending on who you believe,
Right, sure.
What's a really bad number for, how many petabecquerels is just lights out, nightmare scenario? I'm just curious. Okay.
So I'm going to nerd out just a little bit more for you.
Perfect.
Okay. So when I said becquerel, I was it disintegrates per second, right? I'm whatever. So the question, though, is what kind of radiation is it releasing?
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's not so much just the quantity, but
but what's actually being released. And so that's really important, because if it's something like an alpha particle, and these are really high energy particles that get released for radiation, but it won't penetrate your skin, right?
Right.
You're like, oh yeah, I'm good. But if you were to inhale it and get it into your lungs, that's the smokers.
Mm-hmm.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So we tend to talk about radiation and radiation exposure, and we take into account kind of how it impacts the human body, the type of radiation that's occurring, because we know that depending on your exposure, you'll get different types. And so we'll tend to use a different kind of terminology and one that might be a little bit more familiar if you just care about radiation exposure, and that's what's called a sievert. Okay. So the average person gets about 3 to 6 millisieverts a year. And what is it from? It's because they're getting x-rays, they're flying on planes, they're drinking food, they eat lots of bananas, you know. You know, maybe they happen to be, you know, they live in a building that has lots of concrete, right? Huh. So that's kind of the average person's exposure. If you worked in a nuclear power plant, you're a radiation worker, you know, worked with CTs and all that stuff, 50 millisieverts for your whole body is about 50 millisieverts a year. That's the regulatory limit.
Okay.
All right? Okay. 100 millisieverts a year, that's pretty much the lowest level that we know of that you have a documented increase in cancer risk.
And how does one get to 100?
Right?
When it normally happens.
Right. So 100 millisieverts a year, you're talking about pretty much direct exposure to radioactivity, like on the order of you were right there when Fukushima, when it had its, when they had the accident, you were right there.
Gotcha.
You know, and you got that direct exposure right there. And so when you talk about how many people died from radiation, you know, exposure in Fukushima, it was really one.
Crazy.
Right? And you're really? Because that was, it released how many petabecquerels into the environment, right? So that's, that's exactly right.
Well, that's wild. It's good to hear.
Okay.
All right. So what have we, really learned? What went well and what could we have done better? What could have gone worse? And, you know, how do we apply all these learnings going forward in disaster planning around nuclear facilities? You know, to make sure that had it been some other radioactive element that didn't disappear in 3 days or whatever,
Well, so many of the power plants are kind of similar in kinds of the composition of the elements that they have in terms of radioactivity. That's that, you know, there's a lot of similarities amongst these types of plants. There's some differences, but that's kind of a starting place. So I guess number one is follow the safety rules.
Right? Good.
Follow the safety rules. Make sure that your plants are getting inspected, you know, spend the money when you need to spend the money, you know, keep your workers well-trained. I mean, that's clear, right?
Sure.
You'd think.
And where do you build nuclear power plants, right? Sure. So, and that's a really tough question because you're like, how could you have built nuclear power in Japan when we know you have so many earthquakes? But it wasn't the earthquake that really took it out, right? It was the tsunami that came in.
Right.
And really, you know, damaged that power plant. And those are hard to predict.
Yeah. That's a gentle way of putting it. Right.
Yeah.
But I think these are important questions because of kind of what we've been, working towards a little bit is this question of, and this is a broader question we can talk about more another time, which is the broader question of where does nuclear fit into our clean energy future? Mm-hmm. And this is a really fascinating test case of literally geographically, where does it fit in, but also as the pros and cons of the completely clean energy, yet the disaster potential, and also, of course, the bigger question of where and how we store the waste that has a much longer shelf life. That's kind of where I'm really interested in sort of the best practices we've learned. How do you feel like this has affected nuclear's reputation as a power source? And do you have any sort of position on nuclear energy being so close to it?
I think it set back anyone who wanted to build a nuclear power plant you know, decades.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, decade, you know, wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, you know, after Chernobyl, there was a big, right. We don't want to do this. And certainly after Fukushima, it's the same response.
Well, it sounds like nothing bad even happened.
Well, I mean, you got radiation released. Yeah. A few people died. I mean, it wasn't great. A lot of fear, a lot of concern. I think there's a lot of mental health effects from just fear, right? Of what radioactivity could do to you.
But doesn't that compare? I mean, again, this is a really simple, stupid analogy. But you know, we talk about. I was listening to Yuval Harari's new book, and people have made this point a thousand times, but fear is so important. You know, we look at how much we spend on the quote unquote war on terror and how many lives is taken versus the fact that, you know, in 2017, 33,000 Americans died in car crashes or what obesity does or sepsis or things like that. And just putting everything in perspective, you know, the pros and cons of these things, you know, yes, it was a disaster. And yet what it could do for us so quickly to help bring down the carbon in the atmosphere.
But I think it's also control, right? I mean, you know, when you're driving, you know, there's some type of control. You're in the driver's seat and the accident's not going to happen to you. Whereas
it turns out statistically it fucking is.
I know, but I think there's, you know, this psychological.
Well, it's the same thing as flying. I'm terrified of flying and I honestly think most of it is because I'm not in control.
Yeah. But in terms of nuclear energy, I mean, there's a lot of pros and there's a lot of cons. I mean, I'll just be flat out with you. The biggest kind of con for nuclear energy is we don't know what to do, you know, with the spent fuel rods.
Yeah. And I would love to have another conversation with you, a longer one about that.
Many people are worried about, oh, there's going to be an accident, you know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, you want to, because when the nuclear power plant has an accident, that's a very different, you know, level of accident than, you know, when your coal plant has an accident, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I get that. But I would just say, you know, right up front is what do we do with the waste?
Right. Nobody
wants it. Right. What do we do with it? How do we deal with it?
There's been some interesting journalism recently about, and Brian will love this being from Chicago. I was doing some preliminary reading talking about how there's 60,000 tons of radioactive waste on the Great Lakes shores because America's done such a poor job of developing much less facilities, but even a plan of what to do with this stuff. And that is like a fundamental question of how and what, where do we do with this?
Yeah, no one wants a nuclear power plant in their backyard. Nobody wants the waste in their backyard. But I'm like, do you know where the waste is? It's pretty much in everyone's backyard right now because nobody knows what to do with it. So yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, a big problem. Mm-hmm. And we have ways to reprocess it, you know, put it into forms that make it certainly less reactive and kind of, you know, put it in and hidden away. But we have very, very few facilities that are capable of doing that process.
Right.
The Savannah River site, that's just really, you know, an hour and a half down the road from me. You know, they're one of the main sites for this. And you know, they're working nonstop and it's going to take them decades to just deal with the waste that they have on site. And they're just storing it because they don't know what to actually do with it.
All right. I feel like we need to have another conversation about that because, again, what we try to do is, you know, we'll have, this is like our, I don't know, 13th conversation on the ocean and we're trying to attack it from different perspectives. So people really, when people are like, save the oceans, be like, well, it's pretty fucking complicated. You know, there's a lot going on from warming and lobsters to radioactive waste to, you know, yada, yada, to salinity. And I want to do the same thing for nuclear because it is such an important question from the past.
Will say I am not concerned about radioactivity at this time in harming our oceans.
That's great to hear that
things may not happen in the future, but right now we're, you know, there are other really bad things that we have to worry about in our oceans, and it's not radioactivity.
I was going to say, it has enough. It's good that we don't have to worry about this too.
You know, it's not Fukushima, it's not Chernobyl, and it's not even the material that's being dumped up there that was dumped into the oceans, you know, from, you know, releases or, you know, submarines that have like never been recovered, those kinds of things, right? So that's good news. Is that good news?
God, thank God.
Kind of.
So let me pivot a little bit to sort of how we kind of culminate this main part, which is, again, as I tried to paint earlier, I'm not even going to begin to pretend that our listeners, despite how nerdy and progressive they are, all feel the same way about nuclear power. Let's do, though, finish up with our sort of bread and butter and action-oriented question. One of our overarching goals is to shine a light on where we need to go as a people. This is where we try to differentiate ourselves a little bit from a traditional journalist who says, here's the facts, do what you will. What do you feel like are the big actionable questions the rest of us should be asking of our representatives, both current and incoming, as we try to plan a cleaner energy future like tomorrow?
I think there's a lot of excitement and a lot of technological development in renewable resources. And I think there's a lot of opportunities to do those renewable resources along our coasts. You know, if you want to bring the oceans into it, putting out wind farms, right, along our coastline, ways that we can take advantage of kind of the natural energy of our planet and translate it into energy that we can then use, because we all like our phones and our cars and, you know, other things. So I guess that to me is really right your centers about supporting innovation and technology in these areas. I mean, it is so much that we can do and so much exciting basic research that we're, you know, it's like every day we're getting closer and closer, better batteries, better energy transmission. And you know, we just need to support it and not think that it's unimportant or pull away from it because there's a political, you know, you shouldn't do it because there's no such thing as climate, right? I mean, that's always such an interesting dynamic to me. No, you should do it because this is technology, this is workforce development. You know, you are solving problems in ways that, you know, you can't solve if you just kind of focus only on one aspect. So that's my high horse.
I love it. No, I think that's great. And do you, I mean, the quick answer, do you see nuclear as part of that future?
I don't think we need it. I mean, I think there's a lot of pros to nuclear energy. And I think if you had asked me 25 or even 30 years ago, I would have been like, yeah, I think maybe we should do nuclear energy. And now I'm like, by the time we get that next plant built, we're going to have already made such huge strides in the next, you know, fuel cell, in the next, you know, wind farm, you know, energy transmission, in, you know, the next solar panel. Forget it.
Nice. I'm into that. Then there's no spent fuel rods to worry about.
Well, to be clear, we have a shitload still fuel.
Yeah, no more.
All
right. Awesome. Well, we're getting pretty close here. We've had you for a while, and we really cannot thank you enough for being here.
Mind blowing, doctor.
Yeah,
really
seriously.
Oh,
plus, I learned so many new words.
I'm going to quiz you on all those words. Right? I'm going to make you spell
them.
Really
thought about it.
No. It's awesome. This is
that girl's got a Q in it. I wasn't expecting that.
Didn't see that coming.
So, doctor, who else? If you can think of anybody off the bat or not, that's fine. You can email us later. But who else should we talk to? People like you, world changers in the areas that are affecting all of us today. You know, into the next 10 or 20 years.
Oh my gosh. Well, there's so many really great people out there. You know, there's someone who I really admire and I really like to read what they talk about. And his name is Bill Schlesinger.
Okay.
And he's from the Carey Institute. He actually is super, super smart guy. He's a professor emeritus at Duke. And he thinks a lot about, you know, environmental questions and biogeochemistry and you know, how do we build a sustainable Earth? And he's a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. I mean, he's really, really cool.
Awesome.
Nice.
That's awesome. I think he'd be a really interesting person to talk to and think about that. And there's a few others that I think is pretty cool. One of them actually is my colleague. Her name is Lori Zielkowski. She spends way too much time in Antarctica.
She didn't happen to just stab somebody for spoiling the ending of books, did she?
No, but I think, you know, but this idea of doing science and being in this really small, you know, group of people and this kind of environment, right? And,
I think we've had at least two podcast guests on in the past that were about to go to Antarctica or have just recently gotten back from Antarctica.
People tend to record with us and then go into the wilderness.
Yeah, which is fair.
Well, listen, I'd love to get all those names from you and heat these people up. And obviously, of course, the more ladies and people of color we can get on the line to help get their voices out there, the better. Doctor,
now it's lightning round time.
Lightning round time. Few things, then we're going to get you out of here to keep making sure we're still alive in the ocean. Doctor, when was the first time in your life when you realized you had the power of change or the power to do something meaningful?
I think it was probably pretty late. I was already probably in graduate school, and I started interacting and working with students of color and trying to get them excited about science. And I realized that I could do really great research, but I could really make a difference in students' lives by, you know, getting them excited, you know, particularly students who traditionally don't get that access into about science and how cool and awesome it is.
Yes. Very good.
I love that. Okay. Who is someone in your life that has positively impacted your work in the past 6 months?
Probably someone who I think about a lot, who's always been very impactful, besides my husband, who is super smart and always tells me when I'm full of crap, is a gentleman by the name of Robert Fennell, who was a professor here, who recently passed away. But he was always just so good at, I would tell him all my ideas and he would kind of say, okay, you know, and walk through them and calm me down and just a wonderful, wonderful sounding board. And, you know, I'm sorry he's gone, but he, very impactful on my development.
Well, that's awesome. Well, we are thankful for him then. That sounds pretty, pretty important to have somebody like that in your life. Doctor, things are complicated out there these days. What do you do specifically when you feel overwhelmed by everything?
I do athletic activities.
What athletic activities?
What do you have?
So I like to play soccer, or I bike to work, or I get rid of excess energy by making my body really tired. I have a wonderful group that I work out with because that just releases my stress. So I need to do something like that, or I will probably kill people, and there are too many people in jail.
I know the feeling.
That's such a good one. I had such like a shitty day of work the other night, and all I could think about was going to the gym the next morning because I knew that was going to help, and I did, and it was so wonderful, so much better than, like, you know, doing something stupid and not helpful. Such a great stress reliever.
It is, you know, and you're like, oh, I can't believe I got to go work out. I got to change. I got to get there. And then you do it. You're like, oh, yeah.
Oh, no, that was the best.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doctor, how do you consume the news?
So this is going to sound silly, but my parents always listened to NPR, even when I was, you know, really young. So I have taken on that, and I listen to NPR quite a bit. And all of the associated podcasts.
That's great. That's wonderful. That's not silly.
Yeah. And then I'll read like the BBC News if I want kind of a external view of our of our nation from outside, you know, an outside viewpoint.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
That's so well rounded.
All right. this is a fun one. If you could Amazon Prime one book to Donald Trump, what would that book be?
He doesn't read.
Yes, I know. We've dealt with that question. So,
oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Nope. That's it's a very fair assessment. So just for context, we have an Amazon wish list that our listeners, we put every one of these recommendations on, and our listeners can go on there and order the books our guests recommend, and they get sent straight to the White House. So we have had everything from cartoons to the Constitution. So hit us.
Okay. Well, I was talking about this gentleman, Bill Schlesinger. He has a book called Collected Writings and Contemporary Environmental Issues. And I just love reading his books. They're very thoughtful. They're on kind of general interest. They're written in ways that I think the general public can understand on a variety of topics. And I think that would be such a wonderful book for if
is there like a scratch and sniff version of this,
or yeah,
does it come with crayons?
Yeah,
if it came with crayons, or like, you know, fill in the dots or connect the numbers, connect, it'd be great. Actually, you know, but kind of maybe related to this, you know, I've been really thinking a lot about immigration and about the diversity of our workforce, and I just think it's so important that if we are going to really solve the Earth's problems, we have to bring together people who just think about things differently from one another. Mm-hmm. I don't, and so, you know, I think a good book on like immigration and First Nations and who was really here first and how we've kind of change the landscape of, you know, this country that we've grown up in. And for me, my, you know, I'm of Puerto Rican and German descent. And I think it's interesting being Hispanic, and people always talk to me about being Hispanic as being an immigrant, but really it's my German side that was immigration most recent. Mm-hmm. I just think that, yeah, we could do so much and really just, we know we can solve problems better when we bring different viewpoints and different experiences to the table. So something on that, I don't know what the right book is. Maybe you could ask some other guest about what that book might be.
Yeah, no, we'll
and
get
you
on
can
it.
Then recommend it back to me and you know, to really just think about this on a broader scale.
I love it. It's
totally unrelated to science.
Nope. it's so related to science though. It's amazing. I mean, It is so vital to get more voices involved in science, because we just have no idea what's going to come of it. It's a fundamental way of looking at the world. Awesome. Doctor, where can our listeners follow you on the internet?
They can't.
Hey, that's a hell of an answer too. Can they follow your work or your workplace or something of that nature?
They can follow my work on a website. I do keep my website up to date. You can, if you just Googled my last name, Benitez Nelson, because there's just not many of us in the world, you'll find me and you'll find my website, and I'll talk about kind of all the latest and greatest research that I'm doing.
Perfect. Awesome. That works for me. I'm getting close to downgrading to that to myself. Doctor, thank you so much for your time today. That was such an enlightening experience, and I think will help clarify for so many people the issues at hand and the history, and also how to have productive conversations going forward, which I know seems crazy, but I think those are so essential, and we thank you for help illustrating that for us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Awesome. And maybe we'll all get to go hang out with Dawn Wright one day.
One day.
Oh my goodness. Isn't she just the coolest? I love it.
I don't know if we'll be able to find a hall big enough for all of the members of the fan club, though.
I know.
She's wonderful. We'll just line her up and yeah.
I love it. All right, doctor. We'll let you get out
of
here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Keep kicking ass out there, and we will talk to you soon.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Have a great rest of your day. Bye.
All right, bye. Ciao.
Thanks to our incredible guest today, and thanks to all of you for tuning in. We hope this episode has made your commute or awesome workout or dishwashing or fucking dog walking late at night that much more pleasant. As a reminder, please subscribe to our free email newsletter at importantnotimportant.com. It is all the news most vital to our survival as a species.
And you can follow us all over the internet. You can find us on Twitter at importantnotimp.
Just
so weird. Also on Facebook and Instagram at Important Not Important, Pinterest and Tumblr, the same thing. So check us out, follow us, share us, like us, you know the deal. And please subscribe to our show wherever you listen to things like this. And if you're really fucking awesome, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Keep the lights on. Thanks.
Please.
And you can find the show notes from today right in your little podcast player and at our website, importantnotimportant.com.
Thanks to the very awesome Tim Blaine for our jamming music, to all of you for listening, and finally, most importantly, to our moms for making us. Have a great day.
Thanks, guys.